Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
I thought City started all right last night, actually, but even before the first whistle went, there was an inquiry going on in the press box, in the away end at the Tottenham's new stadium as well, and they were all saying, has Pep got it right? It looks like Pep didn't get it right, and Pep Guardiola, it seems, is human. Who knew? Honestly, I seriously was beginning to think that he might have transcended the mortal realm and become manager of some team of demigods, including, you know, Johan Cruyff and maybe someone pre-war, Eusebio perhaps. Really, I didn't think he was earthly. I especially didn't think he was earthly when he strolled out, and I know he wears it a lot, but this collection of knitwear that Pep Guardiola's got, honestly, that hooded, buttoned-up, woolly cardigan thing, it looks warm. It looks very snuggly. I'd quite like one, actually. I would like to wear one, you know, on a Saturday morning with a hangover, sitting on the sofa watching James Martin on ITV or something like that, you know, maybe with a rolled up cigarette just sitting in the top pocket, that sort of thing. But I wouldn't wear it out. I might go to the shops for a Diet Coke and a Twix, but I'm not going to wear it out. I'm not going to the pub in it, put it that way. I'm definitely not going to wear it if I know I'm going to be on TV, and worse still, to a Champions League quarter final. To be fair, that's probably not why City lost. I'll concede that much, that Guardiola's dress sense may not be the reason. Realistically, the team that Guardiola chose probably is the reason they lost. It was always going to be a tactical battle between two of European football's greatest minds, I think. Certainly two of the greatest managers. Only Jurgen Klopp and Jose Mourinho have faced Guardiola more than Pochettino. But last night was only the third time in 15 attempts that Pochettino has beaten him. Now, to be fair, remember that Poch was, of course, Espanyol boss, while Guardiola was at Barcelona, so not quite fighting fire with fire there. But on this occasion, I actually think Pep beat himself. Remember last year when Liverpool thrashed City 3-0 at Anfield, and the controversial decision on that night by Guardiola was to bench Raheem Sterling. Now, he played Ilkay Gundogan and Fernandinho in midfield. Clearly, that backfired. It was 3-0. Last night, he tried to keep his team in hand again, a little bit like a jockey, just trying to sit in the early part of the race with the reins firmly held onto, pulling the horse's head back and just saying, nope, we're just going to sit tight and not overblow ourselves here and not lose the race. He was trying not to lose the game, as opposed to going out and trying to win it. He was clearly a little bit scared of getting shredded to pieces by giving too much space to the likes of Son, Ali, Kane and Eriksen. But that's not how City suffocate teams. City suffocate teams by having the ball so much that there's nothing they can do. They can't get the ball. If you can't get the ball, there's nothing Christian Eriksen can do. And it meant that Kevin De Bruyne, widely regarded as one of the best creative midfielders in the world, was confined to the bench in a Champions League quarter-final. I know City have got a big squad and a deep squad, but I mean, crikey. It wasn't the only curious decision, mind. Riyad Mahrez was handed the start ahead of Leroy Sané. A strange choice. It's not like Mahrez has set the world alight. They paid 60 million quid for him. He's had a few good games, but I don't know if he's been better than Leroy Sané. And even more curious than that was the fact that Pep did recognise that he needed to change and needed to utilise the world's most expensive bench. But he gave them 2 minutes plus added time. What? Why? That double substitution so late in the game. Ironically, they very nearly did make a difference. Sané was a nuisance. That Kevin De Bruyne free kick right at the end almost drew yet another mistake from Hugo Lloris. But Pep, of course, was the master of spin. You know, even if his performance on the team sheet wasn't great, his sartorial performance wasn't great, he was good in the press conference. As if he said, sometimes even 1-0 is better than 0-0. He actually tried to claim that it was better for Man City to have lost the first leg than for them to have drawn it 0-0. I mean, that is insane. That is some Trumpian spin from Pep Guardiola. If he actually thinks that we're going to sit here and believe that 0-0 would have been a worse scoreline for his City team, then he really must think we are idiots. Now, I'm not denying that we're not. You know, we are idiots, more than likely. But even I know that drawing a game is better than losing a game. I mean, come on. But also, Pep's got previous for this. The reason he has such a great line and such an incredible line is because he hasn't won a Champions League quarterfinal knockout match since 2011 away from home. That's a staggering run for a guy who's been there a lot. He's, of his 26 knockout games away from home, he's only won 6 of them. So he's not been brilliant in knockout games away from home in the Champions League. I appreciate that that is the most difficult games there are. You're playing against the top clubs in Europe who've been whittled down to the last 8 or the last 16, and you're away from home. So I get that they are the hardest games, but he can't say, well, you know, one of the things that I've mastered is playing away from home in the Champions League knockout, because he simply hasn't. If he really believes that City weren't that bad last night, he said they played an incredible game. He said that when we don't play good, I am that guy that says so. If he really believes that, he'll pick the same team for the second leg and say to them, do what you did last time and we'll win this tie.
Love Sport.
It was home wins all round for English teams, well, sort of, for English teams in the Champions League last night. Tottenham winning 1-0 at their stadium, but Liverpool also winning, beating Porto 2-0 at Anfield. It could have been more as well. One man who was there was Lee Croft, former Man City winger. Lee, were you impressed by what Liverpool produced last night, and should it have been more than two?
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed. Yeah, I think it was pretty much cruise control, really. I think he could have had more, probably would have liked to have more, maybe going into the second leg. But I think it was a decent performance, good result, and I think he'll probably be enough to see him through.
Mo Salah, they say, should have had a red card. Now, I'm a Liverpool fan, so I'm basically biased on this one. But do you think he was lucky to stay on the pitch?
No. No chance.
As in, you wouldn't have sent him off?
So. No.
It did seem like, I mean, there's a lot of people saying it was high. He went over the ball. He caught him quite high on the shin. I appreciate probably when you were playing, that was never a red card. But in a modern game, do you think on another day?
Maybe, even though a different referee who has a stronger views on it, but you know, I'm not one to advocate or to like to see players get sent off. So
no,
especially
exactly.
Not players like him,
and especially not Liverpool players. If you're me, Jordan Henderson's been getting a lot of stick lately, but I think if you saw the celebration when he scored against Southampton, he felt like he'd answered a bit of that. I saw him play some really brilliant slide rule passes last night as well. Do you think he's really coming into his own as a midfielder?
Yeah, I totally agree with what you said. He was, you could see on his face the reaction when he got that goal at Southampton, and then he was back in the starting lineup again last night. And as you said, he created, I think it was the second goal with a great slide ball pass. I think he's been good for Liverpool. You know what he brings to the side. I think many people underestimate, probably along with what James Milner brings as well.
Great European nights at Anfield. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but was it a real pleasure to be in the stadium last night? I'm sure you've been there, done that, and seen it all before, but it must have been pretty special anyway.
Yeah, no, I love going to Anfield, especially like you say on European nights. I always try and get down there as much as I can, and I think the atmosphere was great. I think that I see them getting the away goal when they go to Porto, and I think they'll cruise through that, and then we can look forward to a big semi-final at Anfield then.
Now, obviously, since you were at Liverpool last night, you won't have seen a City game, but you, of course, did start your career with Man City. Yeah. How important is it for City, if they really, if they did go out at the Champions League quarter-final stage again, it would be quite damaging for Pep if he actually wants to stand up and say, this is the best team in the world. You can't do that unless you win the Champions League, can you?
Yeah, I think it would be a massive blow, to be honest. But I've spoken to a few people about this, and I still think they've got enough. I still think that when they get Tottenham back to the Etihad, I think they'll get the result they need. I still do see them going through. And like you say, Pep's, legacy at City, he's won the leagues. He could win the league again this year. But I think the one he really wants will be the Champions League. And if they were to bow out at the quarterfinal, I think it could be quite damaging.
Is there any chance they're running out of steam? They weren't great against Brighton. They're a bit tight. They got the win. Obviously, they lost last night. There was a poor missed penalty. This quadruple, do you think it's starting to take its toll on the squad a little bit? A bit tired?
I think possibly, yeah. I think it'd take its toll on on any squad, no matter how good they are or, you know, how big the squad is, you know, having so many games and being in so many competitions. But as you say, they're still in them all. They're still in fighting for them all. And, you know, if you look at, you know, the running now for the Premier League also, I think the City will find they're running tougher than what Liverpool is. So I think it's going to be an interesting last few weeks.
And just finally, Lee, because it's coming up tonight and I've got to try and predict it later on the show, Man United, Barcelona, there's no chance Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to pull this one off again, is there?
you know, I hope so, just for the sake of the English teams. But yeah, if I was a betting man, I'd go with Barcelona, I think. But when they got beaten the first leg, you know, in the last round, I thought they didn't have a chance, and then they went away from home, didn't they? And they pulled it back. So anything can happen.
Never write off Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. That's what I would say, no. I suppose. And the idea of a Manchester derby in the Champions League semi-finals twice. That would be rather special, I think, but we'll just have to see. Lee, thanks so much for joining us and giving us your insight on the Liverpool game last night. That's Lee Croft, former Man City winger, talking a little bit about the Liverpool game last night, which he had the pleasure of watching. I actually watched both games simultaneously, which is a heck of a challenge because I'm not a super genius. There is a guy, a Swedish guy with an IQ of about 200, who can read two books simultaneously. I'd like to see him doing that while drinking four pints of Pilsner, which is what I was trying to do while watching both games last night. But what I thought about Liverpool actually was that they took their foot off the gas a little bit. You know, that second half, Porto had quite a lot of the ball. They had a couple of chances. I thought Lovren and Van Dijk dealt with them quite well. But there was enough there to suggest to me that Porto do carry more of a threat than they did last year. Remember that Liverpool, of course, battered them 5-0 away. In one of those performances that just happens, when you play well and you're in good form, sometimes everything goes in. Everything flies off your foot into the top corner. When you hit the post, it goes in or out. It just worked. But they did get a 0-0 draw at Anfield in the second leg. So let's not write Porto off here. 2-0 is a good result for Liverpool. Important not to concede the away goal. And of course, to get ahead. Also, some good individual performances. Naby Keita, a guy who I think has got a lot of unfair stick at Liverpool this year. He got his way back into the game very, very quickly. That early goal obviously helps. But there were so many occasions when you saw him pick up the ball and drive at people from that inside left channel. I think there aren't many central midfielders that do that. It's a very rare thing. And I think Liverpool fans maybe just need to give him a little bit more time and understand that he has ability and understanding of the game that very few midfielders do. I can't remember in the modern era, Aaron Ramsey, Kevin De Bruyne sometimes. They are just about the few players who pick up the ball in the middle of the pitch and drive from midfield at defences. It's a valuable skill and an invaluable one, actually. So, Liverpool fans, don't write off Naby Keita. He's well worth persisting with. Love Sport. Posh Sports reporter Guy Watts is in the room, and it's our last chance to quiz him for tips for the Masters. That gets underway tomorrow, of course, from 7 a.m. US time, which will be about midday. Paul Mortar will be bringing you updates from that on Up Front, because I'm going on holiday, basically, to watch the golf guy. Am I finally going to see Rory McIlroy get fitted for a green jacket?
I hope so. I love Rory and I'd love to see him do it. Of course, it is his last chance to complete the Grand Slam and majors before he turns 30. He'd become only the sixth player in golf history to ever have won all four majors. The group have won them all before the age of 30 is even smaller. It would be quite incredible. I think he deserves it. You know, of course, he's such a fine player. He's won all the other majors, obviously. And it's funny, really, as Mike Atherton points out, in today's times, it was the major that, as a kid, it was suspected would be the easiest for him to manage. But really, since having a large lead on the last day back in 2011, if you can believe it, and completely butchering it then, he's not actually come that close to winning it. Not in real terms, not in terms of being right in it with two or three holes to play.
No, but he has finished in the top 10 every year for the last 5 years. This is a golf course he plays well.
He plays it well, but there's this problem he's got of wanting it too much. And Mike Atherton's tried to get into, this is one of the great things about the Masters, one of the many great things, and one of the smaller ones, admittedly, but Mike Atherton writing about something other than cricket, and he's equally good on golf as he is on the cricket, and he's tried to get a little into his mindset this year and noting how he's approaching it a little bit differently this year to how he has in previous years. In previous years, he's gone for the more slightly more kind of forward approach, if you like, in terms of the media, in terms of embracing it. He says, yeah, I'm absolutely desperate to win it. You know, I love being here. I love playing this course. This year, it's a little bit more I don't know, it's a little bit more calm about the whole thing. It's, you know, if I win it, great. I'd love to win it, but I don't need to win it, so he says. I mean, whether or not Rory McIlroy's golfing legacy will feel fulfilled if he retires without a Masters win, that's up for debate. It depends how much else he wins, I suppose.
You know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of Justin Rose. When he, you know, early in his career, when, of course, he didn't have a major to his name, and for a long time he didn't, and he said, you know, oh, I'm gasping for it, it's so important to me. And then, I don't know what it was, but there was a point when he just went, you know, if I win a major, great. And then, of course, he won the US Open in 2013, and then he went and won an Olympic gold medal, as he mentions at every possible opportunity. Well, fair enough, why not?
I suppose, the first one to win it.
Yes, exactly. And I just wonder if, for Rory, that is a little bit of growing up. Because I always thought with him, you know, we've all seen the video of him chipping a ball into a washing machine at the age of six or something. He's always been a bit of a ball monkey. You remember he got that awful rib injury one winter because he hit too many balls.
He just kept playing through it. He refused really to take the time off that was so obviously going to be beneficial to him because he loves competing. Mm. And the point was that, and the point it remains really with McIlroy, he's a bit of a streaky player, both within a round and within a period of the season. He goes very hot and very cold. And this season, he's been hot. You know, he's had, I think, six top six finishes in a row, culminating in victory at the Players' Championship. But that was his first win in 52, 53 weeks. Ridiculous for a guy of his quality. But look, let's get a little bit more into the actual detail of how this is going to be won and lost. And crucially for McIlroy, the good news is for him, if not for the spectators hoping to be out there on the course over the next few days, the weather has not been good. We know the practice rounds were curtailed yesterday, threats of lightning and thunderstorms and all that kind of thing. Distance is going to be more at a premium than it normally is because the ball's not going to roll as far. Not everybody can get freebies, if you like, on distance. Rory McIlroy hits it as far as anyone. His distance is going to come right to the fore. The ability to really put yourself within touching distance of a pin from a shot maybe earlier than other players might be able to is going to be really of benefit to him. And that's where it might also hurt Tiger Woods a little bit. He's not, of course, the power player he once was, but he is no less bullish about his chances than he ever has been. He's even still talking about how he might only have one opportunity left to do another Tiger Slam, for goodness sake. Of course, he had all four majors at the same time back at the turn of the century. He's never going to do that again. He's 43 now. Incidentally, he'd be the oldest major winner for 29 years. For what it's worth, I just don't think it's going to happen. Brilliant story as it would be, he's just not going to be the player, I think, who this course is going to suit this week. He's another one who has had, of course, a fantastic Masters record, but it is now, I think, 13 or 14 years since he actually wore the green jacket. That was a few years, of course, even before all the fire hydrant and the rest of it that came out. So I don't think it's going to be Tiger's yet. I think it could be Rory's.
It would be, if Tiger wins it, I think, one of the greatest sporting comebacks. When you consider the sort of the arc of his career, you know, remember that he won his first Masters in 1997.
I know.
This is 22 years ago. Yeah. There are people who have graduated from university who were not born when Tiger Woods won his first Masters. And he's still here at the age of 43, genuinely in contention. I'm with you, and I wrote a column a long, long time ago saying he'd never win another major, and that remains correct. I'm just waiting for the day he finally retired so I can dust
James,
that
you
off.
You will not be the only one who has a tail between their legs on the day that happens. I wouldn't be surprised to see Tiger win another major. I'd be a little bit surprised to see him win this Masters. It would be a fantastic sporting comeback, of course, and the bookies are warning themselves, sort of protecting themselves against it a little bit. He's fourth or fifth shortest to win, even though, of course, he's 12th in the rankings. Mm. Form would suggest he's probably not one of the absolute favourites, but when it comes to majors, no one competes quite like Tiger.
You know, it's interesting talking about distance, though, because, yes, when it's wet, obviously you do lengthen the course, but it also means you can attack pins much more easily, you can stick greens more easily. And when you look at Tiger's average driving distance over the last 52 weeks, it's 300.8 yards. Now, in the rankings, that puts him 40-odd on the PGA Tour. But either side of him, Tommy Fleetwood, Justin Thomas, Sergio Garcia, all guys who we expect to have decent-sized weeks this year. Mm. I don't necessarily think it's about how far you can hit it at Augusta. It's about being able to hit it at an 80% drive and be very, very accurate with it. It's what I heard Tommy Fleetwood talking about it earlier this week, saying, the drive is always a really important club for me. It helps me break down courses. It's not about breaking open courses. With Augusta, it's breaking down. So I wonder maybe if he can find a way to reach his 100% driver with the accuracy, then he'll be all right. But I suppose that's going to be the question.
I don't disagree. Tommy Fleetwood is absolutely one of the guys getting talked about as having a real chance to win. He's one of three English players, I'm delighted to be able to say, along with Justin Rose and Paul Casey in the top 15 of the world rankings, all considered to have a shot of winning here at Augusta this week. And that would be an incredible story. I think Tommy Fleetwood, you know, you say he's around Tiger in the distance rankings, but I think that'll hurt him as well. I agree that accuracy is as at a premium at Augusta as distance, but it's a course that they're lengthening almost every year. It traditionally was ultimately a test of accuracy, but now not quite so much. And I think that could be a difference maker this year if the weather continues to be poor. Of course, it could change quite quickly, although thunderstorms are forecast for Sunday. There's talk of a first Monday finish since Seve Ballesteros was winning it back in the 1980s.
So you said that Tiger's not going to win it. Who do you think is going to win it, Guy?
I think Rory. I nearly always think Rory, but I think this year, if he's not going to win it this year, then when?
It's our year, mate.
I hate to sort of put it like that, and I'll almost certainly be wrong. He won't win it this year and he'll win it next or something, but I see it as this being the moment when things come together. There might be a year when he wins it when it's not so likely, if you like, going into it, that he's going to win it, but I think he's at the right place sort of in himself. He has grown up. I think you're right to point that out. And most importantly, he's playing some fantastic golf.
And I asked you earlier to have a rustle around a little further down the running orders and see if you could find us a long shot. Someone who might come as a bolt from the blue and be in the final pairing on Sunday.
I think English golf's in a great place at the moment. I mentioned three players, Rose, Casey and Fleetwood, who are kind of expected to be in amongst it. There's a couple of players who I've also picked out. Danny Willett, 3 years ago, was the winner, of course, becoming the first English winner since Nick Faldo. He is not going to be the one of the names I throw at you. I'm going to throw two others. I'm going to throw Eddie Pepperell out there, who's as long as 100-1 in some places. But this is a guy enjoying a really incredible time in his career. He's gone from obscurity to a guy that's actually featuring at the thick end of tournaments much more than a lot of people expect him to.
Sixth in the Open last year
on a hangover. And you pointed out to me earlier that he's never played Augusta. He may not have, but he'd never played at Sawgrass, and he came third in the Players, which Rory McIlroy won little over a month ago. So he's someone that I just don't think is fazed by anything, and if he swings it well, then I wouldn't rule him out. And another player who has played there a few times before, Matt Fitzpatrick. He's a little shorter than Eddie Pepperell. He also is probably a little shorter off the tee than he needs to be to really contend, but he does have a top 10 finish at the Masters, and he is a very solid player, and I think, you know, if he can sort of string something together, he could be a name featuring up there on the leaderboard come the weekend.
And just finally, because of course you're a Manchester United fan and they have the small task of Barcelona twice in the next six days.
What a week of sport, by the way. Yeah, what a week.
Honestly, it's a very good thing I'm going on holiday tomorrow because I don't have time to do the show. I have too much to watch. Any chance at Old Trafford?
Definitely a chance.
Really?
If there's not a chance at Old Trafford, then why are we bothering to turn up? Look, if Marcus Rashford is fit, that is the one thing that I'm going to be almost physically sweating on for the next few hours. We saw how much we missed him against Wolves. If we missed him against Wolves, we're going to miss him against Barcelona. I think he has to be fit. If he's fit, and the suggestion is that he probably will be enough to be risked anyway, then I think there is definitely a chance, because even though there have been three losses in the last four games, I still think Solskjaer has created a slightly special feeling among the current group of players, and they know where they've come from this season, how far back they've come from, if you like, to be where they are now. And I think they sense that this could be their last chance, this tie against Barcelona, to keep that something special going in their season. The top four is looking maybe 50-50 now. This Champions League run, I think, has one more special chapter left in it. And if Rashford's fit, I do fancy us. I'm going to be keeping an eye on Paul Pogba, though. He's someone whose performances have been pretty disappointing, actually, for well over a month, and I'm just worried that as soon as it became clear that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was going to get the permanent job, he switched off a little bit and he thought, I've got what I want, I've got a manager who's going to indulge me, I've got a manager who likes me, I can take my foot off the gas. Let's hope I'm wrong.
Guy Watts, posh sports reporter, there are his picks for the day. Eddie Pepperell and Matt Fitzpatrick are your long shots for the Masters, but Rory McIlroy will finally win his first green jacket.
This is Love Sport.
Charlton managed yet another victory last night. They won 1-0 away at Wycombe Wanderers. Charlton boss Lee Bowyer called it the type of gritty performance that wins promotion. They cemented their place in fifth in League One. They will surely make their way into the playoffs. And let's not rule them out of automatic promotion contention. I'm sure that is not something that Andy Marshall, Charlton's goalkeeping coach, will be doing. Andy, how good was that win last night to work hard for it and get the 3 points?
How you doing tonight? Okay.
Yeah, very well, mate.
It was a gritty performance, and we said it after the game, myself and Johnny Jackson. Maybe early on in the season, that's a game that would have escaped us. we showed a different side. It wasn't pretty. It weren't pretty at all. We didn't play the sort of football we like to play. And that's credit to Wickham. You know, speaking to Gareth Ainsworth yesterday after the game, they had a plan how they wanted to deal with the type of football that we can play. And they stuck to it. And they were very effective in what they'd done. So for us, it was definitely 3 points game. But the pleasing thing about it was the nature in which we won it. We had to dig deep. And we saw different characters come out yesterday.
I was going to say, this run that Charlton have been on, you know, it is remarkable when you look at the clubs around them, the likes of Sunderland, Portsmouth, you know, very well-moneyed and well-resourced football clubs. What's been the secret to the way the squad have kept together?
I've said it all the way along. Ever since I've been speaking to you guys on Love Sport, and I've been saying it to anyone that basically listens, it's the camaraderie that Lee's brought. He made it clear to myself when I joined in the summer what he wanted and what he expected from his coaching staff and the type of environment that he wanted to create. And it's no surprise that that is the type of thing that now is coming to fruition. As you quite rightly say, there's teams in this league that are punching with the finances well above what Charlton have. But when you've got a team spirit, a camaraderie, and players that want to fight and stick together and give everything for the football club, but also give everything to the manager and the coaching staff, that's worth a lot more than what a lot of money is.
Of course, you had to wave goodbye to Carlin Grant in January, which was a shame, but Igor Vitekili has taken up some of the mantle alongside Lyle Taylor. He came close to scoring last night. I remember hearing Lyle on the station last week, and he said that the goals will come. This guy is good enough. Do you think it is a matter of he'll get one and all of a sudden he'll get five?
I first saw Igor in the summer, and I was very impressed with him. He took a bit of a nasty ankle injury, and he's been out a considerable amount of time with a couple of different injuries as well. But you can see with the pace he's got, the velocity that he's got and how he can play, he causes defences issues. And where Lyle and Carlin had that partnership of the Carlin would go in behind, Lyle was the more the hold-up or flick-on man or down the channel, Igor's very similar to Carlin how he can play on getting in behind and causing danger. He's just got to get them goals now. And that's the only bit that's missing off his game. And once they start to come, you've got a ferocious partnership there that's more than adequate for this division.
Do you think if those goals do come, it will be just because the luck will change? Or actually, is there a little bit of an evolution of his game? Does he need to maybe be a bit more composed under pressure or try and use a bit more power in his shooting? Is there something specific that he needs to change?
There's a large element of luck in football. I would agree with that. But you create your own luck. You know, luck comes from doing the right thing time and time again. And Igor's trying to do that. And you can see with each game, he's looking stronger. He's looking fitter. He's looking more dangerous. What he's not got, which you just touched on, is that slight bit of composure in front of goal at that key point. He had an opportunity within 3 minutes yesterday and blasted the ball straight at the goalkeeper. And, you know, maybe a little bit more composure, he'd have slotted it down the side of the goalkeeper and maybe had better chance of scoring. But he's getting in these positions where 2-3 weeks ago he wasn't.
Andy, I have to ask you, because Lee Bowyer came out in his press conference, as I'm sure you saw last week, and said, oh, I've been sent a contract, I don't really understand it. Are you pretty confident that the three of you, the dream team on the coaching team, you, Johnny and Lee, will be there at Charlton at the beginning of next season?
Well, it's nice you called us a dream team. That's
Wait,
very pleasant.
You're doing a deep... Andy, you're fifth in League One and you're flying. I can't say anything other than that.
No, we've done okay. The demands that we expect from the players are the demands that allowed us as players to play in the Premier League. So that's the standards we expect from the football club. Myself is out of contract in the summer. Lee's out of contract in the summer. We have no desire to move on. I believe we want to stay. We want to take this club to where it wants to go to. But if there's no contract there, then we're not going to get paid to come in and work.
Do it for free, Andy. That's what the fans will say. Do it for free. No, look, I'm sure every Charlton fan will be desperate to see you all on the touchline first game of next season. Obviously, Lee is attracting attention from other clubs. That's going to happen. I thought it was interesting to hear Lyle say that he walked into the dressing room and said, it's because of you guys as players that I'm getting this attention. He seems confident that he won't have his head turned by anyone.
No, listen, Lee's been in the game, like myself, long enough. He's a very, very astute, very clever player, and he's turning into a very clever and astute manager. You are only as good as the team that you put on that pitch and the squad that you have, and it's as simple as that. If them lads aren't going out, they're doing it for the manager, then the manager doesn't get the praise. So, you know, it's credit to all the players, and Lee's never shirked away from that. He's totally put all the congratulations and all the praise onto the players, and rightfully so, because they're the lads that used to that go out there and do it the same way Lee used to go out there and do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Andy, thank you so much for coming on. Real pleasure to speak to you, and good luck against Luton on Saturday. I know that won't be an easy one, but we'll all be right behind you down the valley.
That's great. Thank you very
much. Cheers, Andy. That's Andy Marshall, Charlton goalkeeping coach, saying he's out of contract, Lee Bowie's out of contract, but they are all desperate to stay at the club and take them into the Championship if they possibly can. They've got 5 games left, and of course that starts with Luton at home on Saturday. High-flying Luton Town. It won't be easy, but you wouldn't put anything past this Charlton side at the moment. They're in remarkable form. Speaking of remarkable, have you heard any Russian managers rapping lately?
Men like here in Holland never shake hands, never solo, never goodbye, never miss, never explain his mistakes or not mistakes. Very arrogant, very selfish, and for me, absolutely the worst referee in the world what I see in my life.
That is MC Leonid Slutsky. I mean, that is absolutely vintage. That's not doctored, by the way. Obviously, we put the track underneath it, but the words are his. They've not been speeded up. They've not been given any. Producer Mike, you're a big fan of rap music. I can't say I'm any sort of expert. How would you rate his flow?
He's up there.
Yeah?
He's up there. And considering it could almost be considered a bit of a diss track because he is going after the referee. So he's got all the elements, you know. I mean, we've had loads of footballers trying to get into rap. I know Memphis Depay is tried his hand at
Ryan Babel. Ryan Babel's a big rapper.
You know, John Barnes, obviously, the past.
You've got to hold and give, but I mean, do it one at of the most right iconic time. Rap you can be slow.
But Leonard Slutsky.
Leonard Slutsky.
That's not a name that you... Oh, yeah, Leonard Slutsky. He doesn't look like a rapper, but in the actual video, which you obviously can't see, he's bobbing his head along. He looks like he's going with the movement. So, for me, that's a 5-star performance from Slutsky.
Yeah, very good. Probably better than anything he ever did in his 6 months as Hull manager. So, he is, by the way, now managing Vitesse Arnhem in the Dutch Eredivisie. Mike, what else have you got for us in your trawling of the internet for weird and wonderful sporting stories?
Yeah, so a bit of a strange one. Obviously, Man United take on Barcelona tonight at Old Trafford. Massive, massive game.
Yeah.
What I found out is that if they don't get through that and progress to the next stage of the Champions League, and if they don't finish in the top four and progress next to next season's competition, most of the players will face a 25% pay cut. And obviously, the papers are kind of going with the line move, if they're going to suffer a pay cut, that may mean that Pogba will be on his way out if he wasn't anyway.
Going to make it a lot easier to get rid of Alexis Sanchez. Cutting Alexis Sanchez's wages by 25%, that's like the GDP of some small Central African countries. Seriously, the man is ludicrously overpaid.
That's obscene. Yeah.
And actually trying to get rid of him is going... That's the problem. So maybe if United really want to get rid of Sanchez, miss the Champions League, contractually slash his wages, and then he won't have such a disincentive to leave. 25% is a big whack, though, isn't it?
It is. It's massive. And obviously it has such a big difference in terms of price ones as well, because I know the Europa League and the...
Just
winning,
doesn't generate the
winning,
same number of money.
It's ridiculous. I mean, the discrepancy between the two. I mean, if you win the Champions League, I think it's something like 40, 50 million. If you win the Europa League, it's about 13 million.
Really?
And that's such a huge difference.
Of course, you and I don't mind a 25% cap cut because 25% of nothing is still nothing. So, you know, we'd be on the same
Do
wage.
You know what I was thinking, though, James? It's like performance-related pay. Mm. Well, how about the MPs trying to deliver Brexit? You know, I mean, they're
the front page, the front page of the Mirror today, which harks that they're making millions from buying and then selling homes with the money that we pay them. And they've spent 2 years trying to get Brexit over the line. And what have they delivered?
Absolutely nothing.
Honestly, our boss was saying this morning, I can't believe the Tories are 9 points behind in the polls. I can't believe anyone's not just saying, I won't vote for any of them. I'll vote for zero. I'll just cut my finger and smear it across the ballot paper. Yeah. Honestly, I think the Blood Party would be anyone at the moment, spoiling the ballot, reopen nominations, cancel the whole lot of them. Sorry, I'm not going to get angry about Brexit.
It's spot on though, isn't it? But if you're talking about like performance related pay, I would feel if I was a footballer, I'd feel a little bit aggrieved if that was in my contract. We know that contracts are these crazy
things. I would have a word with my agent.
Days. It is 25%, a quarter of your wage. Is a lot, especially if you're not on that much as well. That's going to cut it quite significantly.
Well, I tell you what, when Drive Time presenter Richard Lee gets in, he's obviously a former goalkeeper for Brentford, Watford and a few other teams as well. We'll ask him about performance-related pay because I don't think it would be a great situation, especially as a goalkeeper, if you're thinking, I better not concede here. I've got a £2,000 clean sheet bonus. I better not concede here.
Yeah.
I'd be really interested to hear how incentivised these contracts are because I know that some of them are massively pay as you play.
Yeah.
They say with Mesut Ozil's one, for example, that he's very heavily incentivised, which I assume is just an effort to try and make him, you know, put a shift in.
Well, I think so because he missed about 3 months of action and he's reportedly on £350,000 a week. I can't imagine he would have got even half of that if he wasn't even in the traveling with the squad, which I had a bit of debate with my friends about recently because it's like,
Well, if you're gonna talk about being with your friends, I'm going to say that.
But how can that be in a contract that if you don't play, it's like saying if you don't turn up to work, obviously you're not gonna get. So I agree that they were like, oh, there's no way he must have got the full fee. But there's another thing. The reason why Spurs players are so happy to be on smaller wages is because Harry Kane gets a God knows how much percent bonus for scoring goals, and that's what keeps them incentivized to keep doing well. I mean, that's where Levy's made a lot of his money because Spurs are known to have like one of the smallest wage bills in the country
for what they achieve.
And the reason why they're able to stay is because if they do like clean sheet bonus, goal bonus, they do so well in terms of that.
Yeah, but Christian Eriksen makes £70,000 a week, which obviously sounds like a lot to you or me. But
it's not.
If you think about the type of player Christian Eriksen is, like how many people are there as good as him in his position in the Premier League?
Not many.
Two? Maybe three?
Kevin De Bruyne, David Silva, probably.
They both play for the same team.
Yeah.
Honestly, at £70,000 a week, I'm not surprised that he's like driving a hard bargain because he could go to Real Madrid and make £200,000 a week. It's absolutely mad.
Do you think he's off this summer?
I really can't see him staying. It was interesting, actually. Paul Miller, it's funny because our studio engineer is also called Paul Miller. Not that Paul Miller, but the former Tottenham player, Paul Miller, was on earlier this week. And he told me that Christian Eriksen's missus is very good mates with Harry Kane's partner. And they're very settled. They live around the corner from each other. And he said that's one of the reasons he doesn't think Eriksen will be going, because they're so settled. It's a part time of life when it's quite big to sort of uproot everyone and move. But in the end, if someone's offering to triple your wages, doesn't matter how much your wife likes where you live, you're going to go. You know, if someone offered to triple my wages, I would literally move anywhere in the world, whether my girlfriend came with me or not. I can say that because I know that she has to go back to work at 1:30, so isn't listening anymore. I can get away
with it. But I would have thought that Eriksen would look across to his mate Harry Kane and think, well, he's earning so much more money than me.
Same with Dele Alli as well.
You know, in terms of importance of players, I mean, I know Jermaine Genus mentioned in commentary last night that he thinks that Moussa Sissoko has been player of the season. Because
the games he's watched, he's actually been all right in. I mean, don't buy that.
Maybe that. I have seen some good performances from Sissoko.
Yeah, he's played a couple of good games, but this is the thing. He's a bit like Philip Coutinho. I thought Liverpool did a really good job selling him because he's a great match of the day player. But when he doesn't play well, it happens more than you think. You don't see it. Yeah. And it's the same with Moussa Sissoko. He has quite a lot of poor games, but you just
like
don't
Pogba
see
Pogba as well,
them.
I think. He can definitely be put in that bracket.
Well, I mean, I just think Pogba's basically not a very good player most of the time. Very good when he is.
He's a 6 out of 10, isn't he? I think that's fair to say.
Which when you're paying him, you know, £300,000 a week, you probably want a little bit more than 6 out of 10. But here on Upfront with James Gray, it's 10 out of 10 all the time.
This is Love Sport.
And just quickly want to pick up on that Harry Kane injury from last night. It does look bad. Ankle at quite a nasty angle under Fabian Delph's challenge. Just remember that Fabian Delph and Harry Kane are England teammates. They're also more than that. They're both in the England leadership group, which is a sort of five-man group who run the squad. Delph's a very important member of that group. He's a very popular member of every squad that he's in. For whatever reason, players really get on with him. And while I know there were a few words said, I've absolutely no doubt there was no malice in that challenge. None whatsoever. So I think people who are suggesting, and I've seen some of it on social media, that he was out to get him for some whatever reason, are pretty wide of the mark. I don't think there was any of that. Whether you think the challenge was dangerous, it's quite another thing. But in this case, certainly no deliberate malice or effort to put Harry Kane in danger. Now, I made the mistake, as usual, of predicting the games last night. I think I got on all right. Why don't we start with Liverpool versus Porto? Here's what I thought might happen in the game. Again, I've got to fight my heart on this one because I am a Liverpool fan. Jurgen Klopp's telling us not to be complacent. We beat them 5-0 away from home last year, but then drew 0-0 back at Anfield. All right, with a weakened side and the rest of it. Nevertheless, I don't think it's as straightforward as people are thinking it might be. Liverpool have been good. They have been good. They've stood up, and when they've been under pressure, I think they really have done a good job. But I don't know if tonight will be that open a game. First legs rarely are. I think it'll be 1-0 Liverpool. I was very close. You know, it wasn't that open. Liverpool played well. They did play really well. Porto, though, did carry a threat. And I thought the second half suggested that they might give us a few problems when we go over there. But as I think Lee Croft mentioned earlier, former City winger, if we get the early away goal, that's going to kill the tie stone dead. How did I get on with Tottenham versus Man City? Not an easy one either, I think, Spurs and City, because Spurs are at home and their new home. Now, I don't think it'll feel like home yet, and that's important. It will still feel a little bit odd. So I don't necessarily think this will feel much like a home game for Tottenham Hotspur. Manchester City are pretty irrepressible at the moment, almost no matter what team they put out. I would think 1-2. I think Tottenham will score, because City have shown the odd defensive frailty. They've got a problem at left back, but I just think City are too good, so I've got to go 2-1 City away from home. Yeah, fair play to Tottenham. They did surprise me last night. As I say, I think Pep beat himself a little bit. He put the handbrake on the team by picking Gundogan and Fernandinho. And without Silva or De Bruyne or Sane, they just didn't have the same penetration going forward. They still caused problems because you've got Aguero and Sterling in the team. You're going to cause problems. But just didn't think they were the same sort of team. I'm just wondering whether Pep Guardiola is starting to just second guess himself. And, you know, we've seen this, and Ollie Kay wrote a brilliant column. Sorry, the Times' rugby correspondent, Owen Slott, wrote a brilliant column earlier this week talking about how Leicester Tigers have started to second-guess themselves. Well, how Beauden Barrett, you know, one of the great rugby players in the world, has started to think too much about his game and to ask questions. And I actually think a little bit has happened with that with Pep Guardiola. He started to ask questions where he doesn't need to. The answers are right there in front of him. They haven't stopped winning games that much. They're still very, very good. Let's move on to tonight because, of course, Manchester United are in action at Old Trafford. Let's see if I can get my teeth into that fixture. It's very tricky because it's Old Trafford. And, you know, as Guy Watts, posh sports reporter and Manchester United fan, was saying earlier, United at Old Trafford is a different prospect. However, Marcus Rashford's fitness is going to be key because it's the afternoon. I don't have the ability to look into the future, see the team that United are going to play. If he does play, I think they've got a chance, but Barcelona are going to score. They're definitely going to get at least one away goal. I'm going to give United some credit for the Old Trafford effect, and I'm going to go 1-1, I think. It won't be easy, but I think 1-1 United. They won't. Look, it's not a good result because when you concede at home in the Champions League, it puts you in trouble. But I think they won't be out of it when they head to the Nou Camp. The other game, of course, involves Juventus. They are taking on Ajax, Real Madrid's conquerors. I mean, why would you ever bet against Juve? Honestly, like, they're just such a good side at the moment. Cristiano Ronaldo has turned into a team player, which I really didn't expect to ever happen. But since he's gone to Italy, he seems to have really, really got behind them. Ajax are in the middle of a pretty tight Eredivisie title race, a level on points with PSV, having beaten them 3-1 a couple of weeks ago to get back to the top. They scored 9 goals in their last 2 games in the league, so they are going well, but the step up in quality is so massive. I can see them, even at home, just trying to avoid the away goal, but I just don't see it happening. So I can see maybe a tight game where a Cristiano Ronaldo free kick ends up deciding it. 1-0 Juve is the best I can go with. I desperately want Ajax to get something better out of the game, but I just can't see it.
Love sport.
Has anyone ever told you you're too small to play a sport? Not me, because I've usually been too wide. I've plenty of times been told I'm too heavy to play a particular sport. But too small is what Chelsea, Charlton and Crystal Palace told Taylan Jones when he was a youth goalkeeper, and he channeled it and is now a professional boxer. He's going to be part of the Ultimate Boxer bill on Friday, May 10th, Indigo at the O2 London. Tay, giving up football and swapping it for boxing, was it a decision you were backed into, or were you always thinking, maybe I'll be a boxer instead anyway?
No, to be honest, I started boxing really late. I didn't go to the gym for the first time when I was 17, and that was when I went down there. It was just to, you know, get a bit of basic self-defense, keep fit and things like that. I didn't walk into the gym thinking I'm going to be a pro boxer straight away or even fight, that case. One thing led to another, and here I am, that professional, back to the Ultimate Boxer.
Tell me a little bit about your footballing career, because obviously it is always interesting. We talk to a lot of people who end up going on to play professional football, going down other paths. You spent a lot of time playing youth football. At what point did you basically stop thinking that you might go and be a professional footballer?
It was probably when I was about, I think it was 18, 19. I think 18, 19, I was at the time playing semi-pro football for Tilbury FC.
Right.
Farrock FC. Pardon me. Farrock FC. And it was about 18, 19, I started doing really well in the amateurs as boxing. I was putting a lot of time and dedication and a lot of training and effort into my boxing. You know, a lot more than I had done as my football at the time. You know, football is a team sport. You can hide behind players, and you can have a bad game, but your team still wins, and vice versa. You can have a good game, and the team still loses. But with boxing, it's purely what you put in. You know, if you put in 110%, you're going to get results and succeed from it, hopefully. So, it comes about 18, 19, where I was on the verge of thinking of going pro and things like that, and my football was starting to slow down a bit, you know. I wasn't taking it seriously. I was starting to muck about and things like that. So that's when I decided I'm going to take boxing full on, stop training football in between the weeks and things like that, and just go boxing 6 days a week.
Of course, we're counting down to your Ultimate Boxer card on May 10th. And anyone who doesn't know it, it's 8 pro boxers, one night, 50k up top. Having to fight multiple times in a night must bring different challenges. Have you had a slightly different training regime, perhaps, you know, doing a session, having a recovery, and then almost doing another session to try and account for that?
To be honest, I've actually done one of these prize fighters before, a similar set out. I did it in the as a white collar in the Queensbury boxing show, which I won. So I've been down before. I've had to go training, come back home for an hour, then go back to training, then come back. So I've done that similar routine before, and obviously it paid well a few years ago when I won the tournament, and that was a really good night for me and my fans who was there on the night celebrating.
It must have been an exhausting day, though. I imagine that format does really take it out of you.
No, to be honest, I always said, after doing it before, I always said, for me personally, It got easier as the night went on. You're more into your strive. You know, obviously the first fight is the most hardest fight because, you know, it's your first one. You're there. You're wanting to get on to the next two fights. So basically, if you don't get past that first fight, you're not going nowhere. So that's the way on to get really stuck into. You know, once you've got past that stage, or me personally, once I've got to start past that stage, that's when I know, I've had a fight, I've won, I've warmed up, I'm here to do the rest of the business. And you sort of relax more, and you obviously get more into your stride, you know, you get your speed and things like that up. So, and you obviously all the butterflies and things like that have already gone because you've already had that fight, you're already on that high buzz. So everything's just a positive from there on.
You're obviously fighting an exciting weight class, you know, in the 160s, around that area, all types of middleweight are always exciting. But you've sparred with some of the decent guys around there, Billy Joe Saunders, James DeGale, George Groves. Did you always feel comfortable getting in the ring with them? And which of them, and you can say this now because two of them are retired, which of them was the hardest spar?
That's when I thought to myself that I could really pursue a career in boxing because, you know, I was getting in with all these world champions and top guys, And I was doing okay, you know. I was holding my own. I was getting invited back each week and things like that. So I was obviously doing something, right? So that's when I sort of, when I started sparring the top people, that's when I sort of really realised, oh, you know, I can make a go of this. I can do a career and do quite well out of it. But each boxer, as you know, with their attributes and things like that, each boxer was a different spar. You know, yeah. The gal, he was just so awkward, you know. He was just so awkward to spar. He was always like slipping and dipping under ropes and sitting on the ropes and that, dipping and slipping under shots and that. So Saunders just had unreal speed. You know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, so I'm blue in the face. His speed is unreal. And obviously, southpaw, no one likes a southpaw, shall we?
It's cheating. You shouldn't be allowed to box left-handed. You should all have to box right-handed.
It might just be orthodox. That's it. If you can't do it, then you don't box. Make it easy.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, Groves, everyone says that jab is something different.
Yeah,
he's obviously so big.
Yeah, Groves is one of those ones where you sort of be more trying to slip and trying to avoid his jab. You know, so again, I've been with some top people, same with Andy Lee, you know, another world champion in southpaw, awkward. They've all got their own different attributes, which I found hard. And obviously, that's why each one was hard for me personally, you know.
Tate, it's really fascinating to speak to you. Thanks so much for your time and best of luck.
Thank you for appreciating me, having me on, mate.
That's Tate Lynn Jones, one of the middleweight prospects. He's going to be on show Friday, May the 10th, Indigo at the O2 London. Don't miss it. 8 pro boxers, one night, 50k up top. And what's great about these nights is, you know, they are short fights. They're 3-round fights. You can't afford to sit back and let the judges necessarily take care of it. You've got to show that you're an active fighter, show that you're a special fighter as well. And what's great about the opportunity as a fan at Ultimate Boxer is you might see someone who in 2 years or 3 years' time goes on and wins a world title. Tae Lin, for example, is a Southern Area champion. Now, that means he is working his way up the ranks. But if in 3 years' time he wins a world title, you might be able to say, I saw him when he was young and I saw him beat this guy and he was something special. Not an event to be missed.
Love sport.
I want to revisit some of those VAR decisions from last night. But I also want to ask, is football becoming too anal? Like, when did we get so neurotic? Seriously, when did we get so obsessed with the exactitude of the game? During the game last night, no one noticed that the ball had struck Danny Rose's upper arm. At worst, upper arm, by the way. Even after a couple of replays, actually, I still didn't quite know why there was a penalty check going on. I don't think anyone did, even the referee. No one in the stadium had a clue, by the way, because they don't display VAR decisions as they happen on the big screen in the stadium. Even though Spurs have got one of the biggest screens ever, they still don't show what's going on. I had a mate who was stood in the white wall, one of those 17,500 people there, and he was texting me as the referee was looking at it, saying, what's going on? Is it going to be a pen? What's happened? That in itself is a farce. So that's one thing to get angry about from what was a complete joke of a tournament, of an organisation when it comes to UEFA. So that annoyed me. But what also annoyed me is it just wasn't a penalty. I don't care what you say about the natural position of his arms or the silhouette of the players. Sure, maybe under the strictest letter of the law, it is a penalty. But a good referee wouldn't give a penalty there. A bad referee might, but a good referee certainly wouldn't. No one on the pitch appealed for it. No one on the pitch cared. No one thought it was a penalty. The players were baffled. They didn't know what the referee was checking for. It wasn't a penalty. Anyone who's ever watched football, including, by the way, the 22 players on the pitch at the time, knew it wasn't a penalty. It's like porn, right? This is from an indecency case in the US back in the 60s. In the Supreme Court, and the judge in charge, Potter Stewart's his name, was struggling to define pornography. And they came to the conclusion, on the advice of one of his legal clerks, he said, I don't know how to define porn, but I know it when I see it. And that's still true. And it's the same with penalties. Sometimes you look at something and you go, well, that's a penalty. It just is. He's gained an advantage or whatever. And you look at it and go, that's a penalty, that's not. If you showed that Danny Rose incident to 100 football fans, I guarantee you, if you showed it to them once in real time, A, not many of them would notice it, and B, if you told them to expect it, I would be amazed if 10 of them said that was a penalty. Change the colour of the shirts, take all of the bias out of it. It just wasn't a penalty. And that is really the answer. That's why it was such a frustrating incident to watch. Not only was it poorly handled, not only were the fans in the stadium unable to see what was going on, but it was also an example of why the law is an ass in this case. It's an absolute donkey to suggest that that was a penalty. It wasn't a penalty in real time. The referee didn't see it first time around. There was no clear and obvious error. And it's not what a slow-mo replay shows later. It's what we think is a foul at the time. When do we get so obsessed with the minutiae of these things that don't actually make a difference in the game? It could have hit his upper arm. It could have hit his armpit. And it still would have gone over the bar for a corner. And we all would have just got on with it 2 years ago. I appreciate that we should try and get things right and try and get decisions right. But football's a game of grey areas. That's kind of the joy of it. It's why it's so fun. It's unpredictable. No one knows what's going to happen. And as long as a referee is clear with the players and consistent throughout the game, then actually, it almost doesn't matter what the letter of the law says. Let the referees who understand the game. The referee last night, Keepers, is one of the most experienced and probably the best in the world when it comes to refereeing. So not only is it being enacted poorly, but the law itself is wrong. Former FIFA referee and actually referees chief in the UK, Keith Hackett, was on Ian Stone's Comedy Breakfast earlier, and he thinks the handball law is too muddled.
There's massive confusion again around handball, with people playing with the laws and playing with the interpretation. What we've got is we've got the law itself, which is supposed to be in operation. Then we've got Roberto Rossetti, who's head of UEFA referees, saying very clearly another thing. And then we're also bringing forward the new law that will apply in June. So if we can discard what Roberto Rossetti said, was that any unnatural position of the arm and movement towards the ball would be penalised. And he made that very clear with his referees. It's okay to say that, providing everybody else in the game understands that's the interpretation.
Changing the handball law halfway through a season because of something that happened with Nicolas Otamendi. That in itself, and if we're going to blame anyone for anything, let's blame UEFA, because that's a farce. Not only have they enacted VAR in the worst possible way, but they're now actually changing the rules of their or their version of the rules of football halfway through a competition. I don't think it's unfair, but I do think it's a terrible look, and it makes you look like you don't know what you're doing. But then, of course, that would be just UEFA being truthful, because they don't know what they're doing. They're an absolute joke. They changed their interpretation from now the silhouette of the player. If your hands are outside the silhouette of the player, whatever that means, then that is a handball. Honestly, it's pedantry. That's what it is, actually. It's pedantry. And look, I'm usually all for pedantry, but honestly, it's not good for the game. At least Sergio Aguero had the good sense to miss the penalty. That, you know, that makes a bit of sense. But at half-time, I lost it. I'm afraid to say that I lost it. When the BT pundits started to obsess about whether Lloris was off his line early or whether any of the Tottenham players were in the box when the penalty was struck. That rule gets broken every week. If you're a BT Sport pundit and you have to spend 10 minutes talking about whether Lloris was a foot off his line or whether the players were, you know, 2 feet into the penalty box, I don't think you should be on a sofa being a pundit. Find something else to talk about. I don't always like Monday Night Football with Carragher and Neville, but at least they try and talk about tactics, stuff they actually know about as recent players and coaches. Much, much better than sitting around going, well, he's over the line, and the rule says he's not supposed to be over the line. That's not fair. Does it really affect the game? Does it really actually make a difference? This is a rule that gets broken every day. I tell you what, next time Rio Ferdinand, or whoever it happens to be, is punditing, I want him to spend half-time going, well, he's taken 5 yards from the throw there. The ball didn't go out there. He should have gone. You know, that's what they can do for the entirety of the half-time break. And he can do it in a box on his own, talking to nobody, because that's who's going to be watching it. Football isn't a game of pedantry. Stop trying to create these outrageous injustices and blame the referees for everything that happens in football when those injustices are just not there. Sure, a rule might have been broken, but has it made much of a difference? Sergio Aguero's penalty was rubbish. I'd have saved it, frankly, partly because I always dive left when someone takes a penalty because they always put it that way in the amateur game. Really, it was a poor penalty and he should have scored. That's what you should be talking about. Tell me more about Sergio Aguero's penalty-taking technique. Don't tell me more about whether Hugo Lloris was off his line or not.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.